So it's really a great honor to be here, and especially it's a great honor to be talking about not only my model, the universe machine, but also about Ben Mostert's model, Emerge, which, as you might have seen, just appeared on the archive today. So my original title was the universe machine, and the only thing more grandiose I could think of when I was combining two universe machines was the future of empirical modeling. So that's what you're going to get today. Okay, good. So what's the motivation behind both of our models, really? So the motivation is, you've probably seen many plots like this in the past from cosmology, where if you combine multiple different observations that trace different things with different degeneracies, then the combined constraints that you get are much better than any individual observation by itself. And given how successful this has been for cosmology, the natural thing to do is think about what can we do to apply this to galaxy formation. So just in terms of broader context, for instance, we've been having lots of issues in galaxy formation that we've known about for many, many years. So a classic example is galaxy quenching. We've known that galaxies have different colors in different environments for a very long time, more than 40 years. And of course, then we've had in that intervening time many, many different observations of galaxies that are star forming versus quenched in different environments, clustering, et cetera, et cetera. And the question is, can we combine all of these then to say something useful about galaxy formation and why do some galaxies quench whereas others do not? So unlike with cosmology, though, we don't have a nice set of parameters like omega m and omega lambda that we can all agree on to determine how do galaxies form stars. So what have we done instead? Well, we already know that galaxy star formation rates depend a lot on the host halo mass and the redshift. And this is, of course, work that both of us have done previously. But also something that we know is that galaxy star formation rates should depend on the host or subhalo mass accretion rates. And so notice I say depend on or correlate with as opposed to a causal relationship. We can only really say that there's a correlation, but as soon as we say that there's a correlation, then we can learn something. So the evidence for this, for example, is if you look in clusters versus in the field, then you find that cluster satellites are more quenched than field galaxies. And of course, then the subhalos hosting those satellite galaxies also have very different mass accretion histories, often mass stripping in clusters, whereas in the field, then you have mass growth, typically around host halos of galaxies. So even if there's not a causation between the mass accretion rate and the star formation rate of the galaxy, there's a correlation between the mass accretion rate of the halo and the star formation rate of the galaxy. And if we understand the strength of that correlation, then we can understand a little bit more about what causes some star formation rates of galaxies to differ from others. Okay. So for those of you who walked in late, I'm talking about both my model, the universe machine, and Ben's model, Emerge. And I can basically summarize both in a single slide. We both start with the dark matter simulation, which gives us halo catalogs and merger trees. And we both apply a very simple star formation rate as a function of three properties, which is our galaxy minimal galaxy formation model. So we say basically star formation rate is some function of the host halo mass, the mass accretion rate, and redshift. And that's it, right? And so the way that we parameterize this relation is different. And in principle, what you could do is even have a three-dimensional grid where a star formation rate at given any of those three properties, you could have a different star formation rate. But of course, in practice, we both parameterized it to make our lives easier. And I'll talk a little bit more later about the details of the parameterization, so don't worry about that. The main point is that given this minimal galaxy formation model, where we try not to assume that much about the shapes of this function, then we can generate a Mach universe of galaxies, observe that Mach universe in the same way as real observations, or as close as we can get. And that lets us write down a likelihood function for how likely is it that this Mach universe resembles the real thing. And then, of course, we do an MCMC to constrain in the original parameter space of minimal galaxy formation models what are the allowed models that reproduce, or at least consistent with the real universe that we see. And so an important point about this is, again, we try not to put in so many assumptions about the physics just because we have so many observations of galaxies. And just to put this in context, say for every supernova or planet candidate that we have observed, we've observed 10,000 galaxies. And so there's just really an amazing amount of information contained in the observations such that no matter, even if we put something very flexible for the minimal galaxy formation model, we can still get something reasonably constrained out. Okay, so I just want to impress on you this point that now we're able to use many, many more statistics of galaxies than we were before. So here's a snapshot of the Mach universe out of one of the universe machine models at redshift zero. And the point of showing you this is not just to show you a pretty movie, although that's certainly part of it, but also just to show you that we can calculate galaxy positions, velocities, colors, star formation histories, of course, from their dark matter halo merger histories. And so we can really compare with not only galaxy number counts like we could before, but also correlation functions, weak lensing, group statistics, any other crazy statistics that you want to do on Sloan, you can also do in these Mach catalogs. And so then you can really take advantage of a lot more information now than you could previously. Okay. So now, since we're all specialists, I want to get into a little bit of the details of each individual model. And so you can see, of course, I'll have different backgrounds for each different model, so you can sort of keep them separated. What Ben does is he relates the mass accretion rate linearly proportional to the star formation rate. And so basically, there's a ratio between the star formation rate of the galaxy and the mass accretion rate of the halo, and that ratio is some efficiency factor that depends on halo mass and redshift. And sort of the motivation for that is, you might expect physically, that there's some material becoming available as you add more dark matter and gas onto the halo, and then some fraction of that ends up being converted into stars and the rest of it doesn't. And what that means operationally for halo growth is, if you have a halo formation history like this, and you start out, say, at 10, 11 solar masses, then your efficiency is somewhat low, and you have a low star formation rate as it grows, say, the Milky Way masses, then your efficiency increases, your mass accretion rate increases, and you have higher star formation rates. And then as you go beyond that, then even though your mass accretion rate might still be high, your efficiency gets low again, and your star formation rate gets low again. And so that's the basic idea, is you relate mass accretion rate linearly to star formation rate. So you have a little bit of a tricky thing with satellites, and so what Ben does is he has a delayed and rapid quenching model, so similar to what Andrew Wetzel has suggested galaxies do, in that satellites continue with the same star formation rate once the mass accretion rate drops below zero for some number of dynamical times. It depends on their halo mass, but not on redshift. And so basically, satellites continue forming stars until some period after they fall in or after the mass accretion stops, and then they quench. Okay. So with the universe machine, what we did is we thought a long time about how to do something fancier with satellites. And notice I say fancier, which does not mean always the same thing as better. But we want to do something fancier with satellites, and so what we do is, instead of parameterizing star formation rate instead of in terms of mass accretion rate and halo mass, we do Vmax and change in Vmax over time, because you can measure typically Vmax better for satellites. And then the other thing is that in a bin of Vmax and redshift, we have some distribution of galaxy star formation rates, which we parameterize as a sum of two Gaussians, so quenched and star-forming galaxy star formation rates, basically. And then what we have is a correlation parameter between the galaxy star formation rates and then the halo Vmax accretion rates in a bin of Vmax and redshift. And so the idea here is that there's not necessarily a perfect correlation between the most rapidly assembling halo and the most rapidly assembling galaxy. But in fact, there's some correlation between those two, which we can dial down from zero, even negative one. So zero would mean, of course, there's no correlation between galaxy star formation rate and halo assembly rate, but then one would mean perfect correlation, and then you have in-between values. And what really constrains this in the observations is the separation between the quenched galaxies' autocorrelation functions and the star-forming galaxies' autocorrelation functions. Basic intuition behind this is that satellites are more quenched, of course, than centrals, but then also satellites cluster much more strongly than centrals. And so the higher the correlation between halo assembly rate and galaxy star formation rate, then the more satellites that you quench, and then the stronger the separation is between star-forming and quenched autocorrelation functions. And so basically, that observation tells you what is the correlation between galaxy assembly and halo assembly in this parameterization. Okay, so that's the basic idea. We also have, of course, some functional forms for how does the star formation rate scale with Vmax and redshift, and how does the quench fraction scale with also Vmax and redshift. Ask me about those details later if you're interested. Yeah, so there's a detail with that too, in the sense that we use Vmax measured at the peak halo mass, peak historical halo mass scale of the halo. Yeah, and so there are good reasons for that as well, which I'm happy to talk about in detail later. So, okay. So the main point is that with both of these different models, we can match a wide range of observations. And another way to say that is that we can use the information from a wide range of observations. So for instance, we can use information, of course, from stellar mass functions and specific star formation rates and cosmic star formation rates like we could before, but now also quench fractions, autocorrelation functions of star forming and quenched galaxies, weak lensing, luminosity functions, higher order statistics, central quenched fractions as a function of environmental density, and so on and so forth. And of course, Ben's model as well. I'm not going to show all the same slides because it's sort of repetitive. But the main idea is we can then combine lots of different observations. And so some of the differences in our models, I won't lie to you and say that there aren't any differences. Some of the differences in our models come from basically which observations we've chosen to use to constrain everything. And so of course you always have this problem if you don't have always consistent observations. And you can see cases like at redshifts 2 to 2.5 where formally the observations are inconsistent within each other's error bars. Then you have circumstances where you get different answers depending on which observations you combine. And so that's sort of the dirty laundry behind some of this, is that you need to be very careful about which observations you trust or try to combine and how do you deal with inconsistencies between them. But anyhow, for the rest of the talk, I'll talk about things that we both agree on. So one thing that we both agree on is that there are very many different individual star formation histories for galaxies. And so you can see in this panel some of the great diversity as a function of halo mass for different star formation histories. And one of the things that also comes out of both models is then that for star forming and quenched galaxies, as you go back a few giga years, the difference between the star formation histories of quenched and star forming galaxies gets less and less. And so even for massive galaxies, say living in 10 to 13 solar mass halos, once you go back to redshift 1, you don't see so much difference between the quenched and star forming galaxies histories if you select them at redshift 0. So if you're a simulator, you might look at this and rejoice, because then you have so much more freedom to match what our results look like, and so you can say that your hydro simulation looks a lot better. But actually, Ben made a point to say that actually, no, your job is much harder, because now we can say for an individual halo what its star formation history is. So not just what's the diversity over all halos, but for the halo, say, which you have in your Zeeman simulation, what do we expect to be the star formation history for that individual halo? So that opens up a lot more interesting comparisons. And so you can see then for an individual halo what happens if you change various feedback descriptions compared to what the empirical model would predict for the star formation history. And Ben also mentioned in the lightning talk something about quenched versus star forming galaxies and the different stellar mass halo mass relations. I won't say much about that, just see Ben's poster and talk with him about it. Getting back to quenching, we see something very interesting in both our models in the sense that if you look at the quench fraction as a function of halo mass, you find that it drops very rapidly with redshift. And this is something very robust, because where is this coming from? Basically, the stellar mass halo mass relationship is very similar from redshift 0 to redshift 4. And if you look at galaxies, the quench fraction as a function of galaxy stellar mass is dropping quite rapidly as you go to higher redshift. And so the natural conclusion is that this is dropping quite rapidly as well with halo mass as a function of redshift. And so here you can see the same thing with my results. And that's very interesting, because it's telling you something suggestive about why is quenching happening. And so if it were something related to, say, the virial temperature of the gas, actually a line of constant virial temperature in this plot would go something like this. And so if you compare that to a line of constant quench fraction, say this sort of red to purple transition, which is about 50% quenched, 50% star forming, you just find that it has the opposite redshift evolution. And actually, also if you ask at what halo mass does the cooling time basically equal the free fall time, so sort of correcting for the evolving density of gas. And that's more like a flattish thing here. And so then also that's suggesting that it's potentially not just cooling, which is influencing why do things quench or not quench. It's something to do with geometry or AGN feedback. We can also learn something more about satellites and quenching delay times. So as I mentioned, we have some fancier model for dealing with satellites. And so what we find here is we have actually a very broad range of delay times for satellites to quench after they fall into something. And what's the reason for that? The reason for that is you, of course, have quenched galaxies in the field as well as in clusters. And so if you take a galaxy which is about to quench in the field and you throw it into a cluster, of course the quenching time is very rapid. But if you take something which has eaten a lot of gas just recently and throw it into a cluster, then actually it can stay star-forming for a very long time. And that's what we find coming out of our models. One of the most surprising results about satellites that we find is actually that if you compare the fractions at fixed subhalo mass of quenched satellites versus quenched centrals, the boost in terms of the quenching fraction for satellites is not that much. In absolute terms, maybe 20 to 30% at most. And for me, particularly, this is something very hard to swallow because probably like you, I've seen many of these images of clusters where you see just beautifully everything is yellow and quenched. But if you take a step back and ask, what virial radius or what fraction of the virial radius are these images taken compared to the full virial radius of the cluster, then you find something like this, right? And so you're actually looking at a very biased view of what's happening in the cluster if you're only looking at the inner, like 1 to 2%. And if you step out just a little bit, say to 10% of the virial radius, then you already start picking up star-forming galaxies. And so this picture then is that, yes, if you are on a very radial orbit and you pass through the extreme center of the halo, that, yes, then the forces get very strong, tidal and ram pressure and everything else, and so you quench very rapidly. But if you're just orbiting out here in the outskirts of the cluster, it's not such a deadly environment if you're a satellite, and you will often continue forming stars for a long time. And so just the last slide, which I want to say about results, is just sort of an advertisement that we'll be able to predict number counts, of course, for James Webb. And so look forward to papers on that in the future. And so to summarize what kind of results we're getting from these two models, we're learning about what matters for quenching, what will James Webb likely see, how does star formation histories depend on galaxies' current specific star formation rates, or we can also ask how they depend on environment, like cluster versus field. We can also learn more about the halo mass for a given galaxy based on its stellar mass and now more properties. But also, of course, we can learn about the halo mass assembly history, given the galaxy star formation rates are somewhat correlated with halo mass assembly rates. And of course, also questions about, is my hydro simulation right? And I left a blank slide here because I wasn't sure about how much time I'd have left, but I did want to talk a little bit about the future of empirical modeling, because that was the title after all. And so not only do we have now galaxy questions about galaxy quenching, but you can imagine tying in many, many more observations. Because of course we don't just observe whether galaxies quench or not. We observe shapes, we observe sizes, we observe morphologies, and so we observe gas fractions. And so you can imagine then tying in more and more of these aspects. So not just self-consistently what are star formation rates doing, but self-consistently what are galaxy sizes, shapes, black holes, metallicities, gas, everything doing in the future. And so that's really the trajectory that both of us are going in, is that we're trying to self-consistently assemble all the observations of galaxies that we can into a self-consistent picture. So thank you.
Many questions. I can't tell who was first, but I think why don't we just start on this side with Rachel.
So you haven't defined what you mean by quenched.
Yes.
And I think this is a critical issue. We all know that the normalization of the mean relationship between stellar mass and star formation rate declines with redshift.
Yeah.
So if you're just, you know, sort of tracking that decline,
yeah,
then I think that's a relatively uninteresting form of quenching.
Yeah.
What to me is more physically interesting is actually when the ansatz of your model is violated, which means that the halo continues to grow, but no gas cools and no stars mm-hmm. form. And we certainly see that in simulations where we've included physical processes like AGN feedback. That doesn't mean it happens in the real universe, but it certainly can happen in simulations with baryonic physics.
Yeah.
So can you comment on
Sure, I'll comment on both. So I think it's really a two-part question. One, what do we do? What we do we define as quenched? And so what I try to do is go as close to the observational definition as I can. So when I compare, say, against quench fractions going all the way to redshift 3.5, you know, of course, that those are all UVJ quench fractions. And so I generate UVJ colors in my models then to compare exactly with the same cuts. And so in that sense, I'm trying to use whatever the observational definition is as what my criterion is for quenched in observations. For quenched in theory land, as in what happens to, so what happens to things where we know that they're growing, but then the quenched fraction is still quite high. That's still fine. So I still can assume some correlation between assembly rates and whether the thing is star forming or not. But because the quench fraction is so high, I parameterize the quench fraction as a function of Vmax and redshift. So in cases where the quench fraction ends up being very high, then almost no matter what the assembly rate is, the thing still ends up being quenched. And so you find that basically for any massive halo is that there's some redshift or halo mass threshold then, which is approximately where this black area is, where even if you're growing, you're still probably quenched.
A few years ago, Manu Pop and Rick White and I made an early version of your universe machine, and it does sort of qualitatively the same
which
idea.
Which is actually better than what we do.
You grow galaxies inside their dark halos, and we adopted the simplest sort of prescription we could, namely, how do you have galaxies grow as close as they can to the halo growth rate and yet still obey the stellar mass halo mass relation which was imposed on the problem. So it's very primitive. I'm sure it's wrong at some level, but the key thing that we did, which I want to emphasize here, is we put in the sizes of the galaxies.
Yeah.
And the reason we generated mock images and we reduced them in the same way as Hubble images and all of that sort of thing, because we were very interested to see when you would find a difference between forward and backward modeling in this field. And the answer we found was that the differences begin to appear at redshifts beyond about 3, and beyond about a redshift of 6, essentially all you're seeing is selection effects. Mm-hmm. The real information about galaxies is highly edited by selection effects. This is going to be a huge problem for JWST. Just to sort of make this absolutely clear, 1 plus z to the 4th, if z is 9, the arithmetic's very easy, that's 10,000, a factor of 10,000 in surface brightness. Yeah. So you know that the observing galaxies at high redshifts are going to depend very much on how compact they are or not. Everything's going to depend on selection effects, and that's what this early version of the machine showed.
Yeah, so yours was more advanced because it includes size. It also includes the full forward modeling to the image plane, whereas we do sort of basic forward modeling to the stellar masses only. And so I completely agree that selection effects become extremely important as you go to higher and higher redshifts.
So, Peter, I didn't understand something about quenching that you said. So in your model, at least because you're dealing with Vmax and the change in Vmax, I can see that the orbits of these satellite galaxies do matter.
Yes.
But I'm not sure about Ben's model. So are you saying that you somehow, Ben's model can also include this orbital dependence? Because I thought you said that he has only some time delay.
Yes, so in Ben's model, and he can speak to this better than I can, but my impression was that it was just a delay time after you stopped accreting.
So that should not have any orbit dependence, right?
That's correct.
Okay.
So only in my model, but.
So this doesn't, the stripping does in the end, but because there's this, also a model for stripping, and this does have basically an orbit dependence, but the quenching of satellites is not.
Yeah, feel free to ask Ben questions as well as Peter.
Right.
OK. Okay, Jim from Utah. So, so in your model, you just have this. You try to tie the star formation rate, for example, central galaxy, to the instantaneous like a halo mass accretion rate, right? Wouldn't it make more sense to try to tie it to like earlier accretion rate? If you consider like the dynamical time, infall time.
In Ben's model, the mass accretion rate, correct me if I'm wrong, is averaged over dynamical time, and dynamical time. And so in mine also, I don't use the instantaneous Vmax accretion rate, but also the Vmax accretion rate averaged over dynamical time.
Yeah, the observers have been able to measure more parameters in their surveys, they've begun to ask the question, what is the fundamental observable parameter for quenching? Is it, the stellar mass, which might be, as we heard, best correlated with halo mass, or is it a structural parameter such as the surface density of stars or the inner surface density? And I think the majority of surveys which have looked at this, including the Sloan and my own work and also Deep 2, have concluded that the quenching is more fundamentally correlated with, and you can just show this statistically, with an internal property of the galaxy, such as the stellar surface density, or even the inner stellar surface density, as pointed out in papers by the Deep team. I don't think that's been taken on board so far in such models. Would you like to comment on this?
Yeah, I think you're absolutely correct, is that there are definitely internal correlations between galaxy properties like size or surface density and quenching. And all that we can do, of course, we're not, of course, directly looking at those galaxy properties. And so all we can recover is some correlation between what the halo is doing and what the galaxy is doing. And it seems like there's a very strong correlation, for example, between the halo mass and whether you're quenched or not, and also between whether you're assembling your halo fast and whether you're quenched or not, because, of course, that gives you satellites versus central quenching. But beyond that, we can't say if is the actual causation for that something related to the galaxy structure, as opposed to just is there some correlation between what the halo is doing and what the galaxy is doing.
So one thing that is important, of course, as we all know, is that there's a halo mass below which star formation is suppressed by things like reionization and that sort of stuff. And in the paper with Jenqui Lu that we wrote, we found that it was very sensitive to what you do close to that limit and how that limit evolves with redshift and that sort of stuff. So that brings me to the question, how does your model deal with that, and how have you checked that you're not sensitive to your mass limit in the simulations?
Yes, that's a really good question. And at least I have not checked that carefully, because most of the mass functions, say, that go in don't actually go that far down to be really affected by that. So we go down basically to 10 to the 10.5-ish in halo mass, which of course, depending on your model for how reionization affects things, might be okay or just marginal or maybe affected at redshift zero. So I'd be happy to talk with you more and learn more about which observations are really affected by that.
Yeah. So I want to comment or ask a question about the degeneracies involved. So effectively, everyone matches distribution functions at different redshifts of different types, and there are infinite possibilities for individual paths to go through there. Have you, through your modeling, identified certain key observables that may or may not at least rule out certain paths that individual galaxy go through that distribution functions?
Yeah, so one of the big questions is, what do central galaxies do to quench as opposed to satellite galaxies do to quench? And so a lot of the observables that we have, say correlation functions, will tell you a lot about what the satellites are doing, but somewhat less about what the centrals are doing. And so one observation that is potentially very helpful is to select out, to look at centrals to the degree that you can, to do some isolation cut or whatever. To try to select mostly centrals to inform, say, correlation functions or environment, quench fractions with environmental density, that kind of thing, to get more at what the centrals are doing as opposed to the satellites only. And so information like that is really helpful, and especially as you go to higher redshifts, too, to have things like projected correlation functions, which of course people are pushing on, but it's hard.
Well, unfortunately, we're out of time for our questions for Peter. I guess hopefully you can find him during the lunch break. Let's thank him again.